Blog Talk Radio.
His name is Malik Zulu Shabazz. Malik Zulu Shabazz.
It is indeed my honor and great joy and privilege to be invited by brother and Dr. Malik Zulu Shabazz, who is one of the greatest student leaders of all time.
I'm talking about terrorism now. We want a war on terrorism. The war on terrorism should have started 400 years ago. Bring the flag, brother. Bring the flag.
Bring the flag.
Because I'm here to tell you that false patriotism will not get you out of this. Holding a bandana flag around your head will not get you out of this. Huh? Flag on your antenna in your car will not get you out of this. You might be saying, God bless America. But when did America ever bless God? You might be saying, God bless America. But God might be damning America at this very hour.
What's all this shit I see on here about harassment and all that bullshit, rap for power? You sumbitches, get out and get a goddamn job and make a constructive citizen out of yourself and stop all this bullshit. You wouldn't have to have no fucking rally for power. You got that message, motherfucker?
I would like to make a few comments concerning the difference between the black revolution and the Negro revolution. There's a difference. When you study the historic nature of revolutions, the motive of a revolution, the objective of a revolution, and the result of a revolution, and the methods used in a revolution, you may change words. You may devise another program. You may change your goal and you may change your mind. Look at the American Revolution in 1776. That revolution was for what? For land. How was it? Why did they want land? Independence. How was it carried out? Bloodshed. Number one, it was based on land. The basis of independence. And the only way they could get it was bloodshed. The French Revolution. What was it based on? The landless against the landlord. What was it for? Land. How did they get it? Bloodshed. Was no love lost. Was no compromise. Was no negotiation. I'm telling you, you don't know what our revolution is. Because when you find out what it is, you'll get back in the alley. You'll get out of the way. The Russian Revolution. What was it based on? Land. The landless against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. And you're afraid to bleed. I said you're afraid to bleed. Long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for white people. But when it comes time to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got no blood.
All right, black power, and more black power to my people. We had a technical situation there. I'm sitting here going in talking about all this good stuff, and you all couldn't hear none of the good stuff that we were talking on. So let me bring it right back to you. Black power and power to the people. This is your brother, your soldier in arms and comrade in battle. This is Sean Kwali. I am happy to be able to broadcast live once again to you from right here in the hills and the smells of North America. As always, I count this a privilege. As always, I count this a joy. As always, I count this an honor to be able to talk to you from this platform that we call and consider Black Power Radio. We give thanks to the one God, the God of our forefathers and foremothers, for allowing us to see another day, for allowing us the opportunity to fight and to continue on in the liberation struggle. We thank that one God for our ancestors, of course, those who have paved the way, given us the example of freedom fighting government, given us the example of chemistry and alchemy and science and true home life, true relationships, true family. We are thankful and we give thanks here, right here on Black Power Radio. And as I said before, you couldn't hear it for whatever the reason was. I got to say it again. I got to say that if we live to be 1,000, we could never think that one God enough for a beautiful, bold, bald-headed black man, 100% black man, who said that his purpose on this planet was to give our oppressor hell from the cradle to the grave. And we have to bear witness that that is indeed what he did. We're speaking of the Black Power General, the Honorable Dr. Khalid Abdul Muhammad. And we have to give thanks if we reach the ripe old age of Methuselah, whatever our age is. We have to give thanks for our brother and champion, who is carrying on in the tradition of freedom fighting, carrying on in the tradition of struggle, carrying on in the tradition of black power and black liberation. We're talking about the attorney at war and that five-star general. We're talking about Dr. and Attorney Malik Zulu Shabazz. And I want to again welcome you all to Black Power Radio. And for those of you who tune in with us every single week, we thank you, we honor you, we appreciate you. And we thank you once again on behalf of the new Black Panther Party. And I do want to say, I don't know what the hell was going on, but hell, we got to roll forward. This is Black Power Radio. Tell a neighbor, tell a friend, tell your cat, tell your goldfish, tell your dog, Black Power Radio is successfully on the air. And we intend to hear from a beautiful, bold black woman. We intend to hear from one who has crisscrossed this country on behalf of the liberation struggle. She has continuously organized on behalf of prisoners of war and political prisoners. She has continuously fought with every means available to make sure that the liberation struggle continues. She has not given up the fight like so many in the past. She has not said, now that I have reached more mature age, now that I'm going to stop and sit down. She understands that revolution is a process. Revolution is a process, and it is a lifelong journey and a lifelong struggle. If you're going to be involved with this, if you're going to be involved with this movement, this is something that, hell, that you have to commit your life to. You have to commit your soul to, your body to. You have to commit your mind and your heart to. This is for freedom or death. This is for the gusto. This is either we're going into the end zone or we ain't even going to play the game. All right? And so we're here to hear from a political warrior, an activist, and a sister who is a champion for the mind and hearts of the people and oppressed people. She is an accomplished writer. For those of you that understand about the pen and the necessity of using the pen, she's an accomplished author and she blogs. She's an accomplished organizer, comrade, and friend to the National Minister of Defense of that time, of the Black Panther Party formation in 1960, Minister and Dr. Huey P. Newton, a comrade and friend of that great general and field marshal and black guerrilla family founder, General George Jackson. She is one who has worked in the trenches. And so in a few moments, we will hear from her. And I'm just as anxious to hear from her as you. And I'm one of her sons in this struggle. If it was not for her and the sacrifice that she made coming up out of New Haven, Connecticut, and crisscrossing this country, we would not be fighting like this today. And so we give honor for every Panther regiment. There's no set trip in here. And we intend to hear from my sister. And before we go into that, I want to say that our show is also, it will be co-hosted tonight by our National Deputy Field Marshal, that beautiful, bold black woman coming up out of Atlanta, G8, putting in work, kicking butt and taking names. I'm trying to keep it child-friendly tonight. Kicking butt and taking names. And she comes in the tradition of freedom, fighting, and struggling, coming in the tradition of one Asada Shakur. And I have to say again, hands off Asada Shakur, sending a warning to the Castro family. And those of you that's there in Cuba, you make sure that our sister is safe. You must make sure that our sister is safe and secure, and that no hurt, harm, or danger comes to our sister and our queen mother, Asada Shakur. I want to bring on, just for a few moments, and she'll give you a few words of introduction, our Deputy National Field Marshal. This is Sister Queen Nadia Shakur. Black power and power to the people. Sister Nadia Shakur, you on with us? She may have us on mute. I know she said she had to go to a meeting. And so we'll keep it rolling. My brothers and my sisters, the subject tonight is entitled Blood in Our Eye. Blood in Our Eye. Hell, if you have not read the book by now, Blood in My Eye, brother and sister, you are missing something serious right now. You are missing a true gem, a true piece of history. We just celebrated on August the 7th the insurrection of one who we call the man child, Jonathan Jackson. We celebrated, I'm talking about literally celebrated, while many of you celebrated for the 4th of July. We celebrated the man child, Jonathan Jackson, that black man who was 17 years old, who went into the Marin County Courthouse. And on that day, he wasn't talking about passing no motions. He wasn't talking about, you know, going to the clerk and asking the clerk nothing. This brother was upset with the treatment of his physical blood brother, his physical blood brother, George Jackson, who was locked down, I think on a 1 year to life sentence over something as small as $70. Something as small, I think it was $70, he was locked down, all right? He's locked down. He had been targeted already in an early age, and he went through Soledad Prison. If you don't know this story, brothers and sisters, you got to get up on it right away. But in the interest of time, I'll say this, that Jonathan Jackson, who they called a man child, he was upset with the treatment of his brother being locked down behind enemy lines, the Soledad brothers, what they call the Soledad brothers, being locked down behind enemy lines. And so he himself went on into the courthouse. This young 17-year-old black man, armed to the teeth, ready to do what he had to do to get his brother free. I can't wait till Sister Kalu tells the story. Armed to the teeth, ready to do what he had to do. And he goes in and says, basically in words, we'll be taking over from here. We are the revolutionaries. And just, you know, for a little bit of security's sake, he say he's taking old no good devil judge with him. Devil judge, you're coming up and coming out with me. And some others, you're coming up and coming out with us. See, when we're talking this Panther stuff, this ain't just no rhetoric that people are talking. People have put in work, and brothers and sisters are putting in work right now, putting in work for the liberation struggle of the people. And so ultimately, what we're told was supposed to happen was Jonathan Jackson was supposed to be able to leave, because those hostages, those people that he took with him, was supposed to be guaranteed some safety, and they were basically, you know, a point of protection he was going to use. And so ultimately, those no good pigs, they took and shot up the whole van. Shot the whole van up, killing everything that they could inside the van, and even killing the judge in the van, wounded some others in the van. They went off, okay? Went off, lied, and said that they gave an order for a ceasefire, no fire, and said they didn't get the transmission through and all this type of stuff. Basically, they shot the van up and killed everything that they could in there. And this is a 17-year-old young man. I want you all to understand what we're saying here tonight. 17 years old. What is the difference between a 17-year-old young man in that time versus our 17-year-olds today? What is the difference? The only difference is cultivation. The only difference is stimulation, intellectual stimulation. Jonathan Jackson was being intellectually stimulated by some revolutionaries. He was being taught and politically educated by some Panthers, some brothers and some sisters, some black men and some black women that were concerned about the community and were tired of the same old, and were tired of taking the same old mess and the same old crap and going to the same old stuff. And so they, on the basis of the 10-point program, were not about no shucking and no jiving, about no talking and just sitting around talking about what you're going to do all day. They were about observation and participation. And they understood, and the same is in the case in many other political prisons and prisons of war, that there would be no benevolent judge that would free a George Jackson. Same thing in the case of a Mutulu Shakur today, or the same thing in the case of any of them that are locked down behind the prison walls today. There will be no benevolent judge that will free our prisoners of war. The system is not set up to free the prisoners of war. The system is set up to crush the Panther Party. The system is set up to crush all resistance. Here you look at the story of Geronimo Jijaga Pratt. We say our shade for him. That great defense captain, Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, you look at his story. COINTELPRO and the FBI, they knew that he was not where they said he was to commit any heinous act. They already knew it. They had been following him. They knew where he was at. But they set him up. And through a setup, they were able to manipulate the judge, manipulate the jury, and put this man down behind bars for most of his life. And some even say that even the illness that took him away was a result of what he suffered behind the penitentiary bars. And so I'm saying this, there will be no benevolent judges or no benevolent jury. Some of us are too trusting in the system. When you hear the new Black Panther Party and Dr. Malik Zulu Shabazz talk about establishing something of our own and doing something for ourselves, some of you think that we're crazy. We're not talking stuff we don't know about. We're giving you the lens of history. History tells you that if you do not physically liberate the prisoners of war and the political prisoners and those who are even on the streets right now, that there will be no liberation. All right? If you don't physically organize to liberate those, and the reason why I include those of us on the streets is because many of us are in jail too. If we don't organize to liberate those that are on the streets and behind the jails and the penitentiaries, there will be no liberation. There's nobody passing any motion in any courts or passing any document in any boardroom that has anything to do with the liberation of the oppressed masses of our people. Nothing at all. They have no aims, desires, or wants at all to liberate you and liberate me from this condition. And so we have to struggle. Bottom line, we have to struggle and we have to fight and we have to continue to push forward. All right? And so, brothers and sisters, we're going to hear a few words from Minister Malcolm X. And behind Minister Malcolm X, we'll bring on our sister, Kilu and Yasha. Black power to black people. Come back.
And when we say this, the press calls us racists in reverse. Don't struggle only within the ground rules that the people you're struggling against has laid down. Why, this is insane. But it shows you how they can do. They make the, with skillful manipulating of the press, they're able to make the victim look like the criminal, and the criminal look like the victim. Right now, when in New York, we had a couple cases where police grabbed the brother and beat him unmercifully. But when it comes time for you and me to protect ourselves against lynchers, they tell us to be nonviolent. because we get tricked into being nonviolent. And when somebody stands up and talks like I just did, they say, well, he's advocating violence. Isn't that what they say? Every time you pick up your newspaper, you hear where one of these things has written into it that I'm advocating violence. And I have never advocated any violence. I've only said that black people who are the victims of organized violence perpetrated upon us by the Klan, the Citizens Council, and many other forms, we should defend ourselves. And when I say that we should defend ourselves against the violence of others, they use their press skillfully to make the world think that I'm calling on violence, period. And I wouldn't call on anybody to be violent without a cause. But I think the black man in this country, above and beyond people all over the world, will be more justified when he stands up and starts to protect himself, no matter how many necks he has to break and heads he has to crack. I saw in the paper where they, on the television, where they took this black woman down in Selma, Alabama, and knocked her right down on the ground, dragging her down the street. You saw it. You're trying to pretend like you didn't see it because you knew you should have done something about it and didn't. It showed the sheriff and his henchmen throwing this black woman on the ground. On the ground. And Negro men standing around doing nothing about it, saying, well, let's overcome them with our capacity to love. What kind of phrase is that? Overcome them with our capacity to love. And then it disgraces the rest of us because all over the world the picture is flashed showing a black woman with some white brutes with their knees on her holding her down.
Brothers and sisters, we are back. All power to the people. Just wanted to drop that on you. That's from Minister Malcolm X. He's talking about being called racist. Right away now, we're at the moment of the hour that we've all been waiting for. We're excited and we're happy and thankful to have this queen warrior on. I know she doesn't like me using that term, but this warrior and comrade warrior on with us. Brothers and sisters, I want you to help me to welcome to Black Power Radio our queen warrior, comrade warrior, the straight-up revolutionary soldier who is on the battlefield organizing for the oppressed masses of our people and throughout the world. This is Sister Kilu and Yasha. Power to the people. How are you, sis?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
So I'm online now?
You're online. You're online.
Okay, sorry.
How are you?
Power to the people. Greetings, everyone.
Power to the people. How
right
you doing,
on.
Kilu?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am. We're honored and thankful to have you on the radio broadcast with us. You got the people fired up and they're anxious to hear from you. So I want to first ask a couple of questions to you so we can get introduced to the radio audience. Could you please tell us about yourself and who are you? Who is Sister Kilu and Yasha?
Okay. Kilu and Yasha is a 73-year-old veteran of the struggle to liberate black and oppressed people internationally.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. How did you...
I've been active... I joined the Black Panther Party in New Haven, Connecticut in 1969 and worked for the People's, was Breakfast Program Coordinator for a minute. Then I was Charles Gary's secretary, who was Huey and Bobby's lawyer. Bobby and Erica and Lonnie McLucas were on trial. I worked through for the lawyers, not just Charles, but other lawyers, in that case until the... and worked for the people in the process, organizing around both of those trials until Bobby and Erica were free in a people's victory. And then I came out here and began working and to visit George and get involved in the movement out here because movement headquarters on all fronts was pretty much in the Bay Area at the time, and in San Francisco and Oakland, particularly Oakland. So, and the Soledad brothers were on trial, and Angela and Rochelle were on trial. Pre-trial hearings were being held for both groups, both Angela and Rochelle and the Soledad brothers. So I went to my former boss, Charles Gary, because George had advised me to get a press pass to be able to visit him, because his visiting list was full when I came out here, and I'm backpedaling just a little. I started my correspondence with him in 1970 when I read Soledad Brother and loved it and had questions and wrote to him, and we started an intense correspondence, very political. And so he even invited me to come out here at his expense, but I declined it because I didn't need it. I was leaving to come out here in any case. So he said, get a press pass. So I went to Charles Gary, got a press pass, and went he sent me to Carlton Goodlett, may he rest in peace, who was the publisher of, was a medical doctor as well as publisher of the Sun Reporter, a black newspaper in the Bay Area. So I wasn't looking for a job. I was looking for a press pass, but Reggie Major, may he rest in peace, was in Algiers covering the international section of the Black Panther Party with the Cleavers and Eldridge and Kathleen. So he was, they needed somebody to fill in for him, and I was kind of on the spot needing a press pass, and so they said, yeah, we'll give you a press pass. Will you do this? Cover the pretrial hearings of Angela and the Soledad, but well, perfect. So I did it, and the pay was lousy, but the job was important, and at that point I wasn't that interested in finances. I was I had committed my life to the struggle. And actually, in final analysis, I walked up out of Sun Reporter after they chopped up my art. They made me news editor, but then after they chopped up my article on Attica, I just walked out and started working on a free newspaper. And anyway, there were a lot of political ed classes going on at my house at that time, and I called my pad LT, Liberated Territory. And I just kept being a Panther as best I could, and with a small p, after I was banned from the Panther offices in San Francisco when I went to get a George sent me to the offices to, you know, get involved with the defense committee, and he had already warned me that there was chaos out there. And so I did that, and but I discovered quickly that I was banned, and that was evidence of the split that was going down at that particular time. And
yes,
lots
ma'am.
Of you may know about the FBI's COINTELPRO orchestration of a split between and among Panthers, and there were some serious I don't like to use the word casualties because it's nothing casual about dying, but there were fatal consequences that Panthers. And I lost my very first comrade who had recruited me into the party. I lost was Robert Webb, who was actually out on his point, but he was deployed in New Haven in New York. And I had, you know, gotten close to him, and the brother was just straight-up beautiful brother, you know. And so anyway, and I also knew Sam Napier, who was second retaliatory murder. And he was a beautiful brother. But one of the beautiful things that's happening right now, fast-forwarding to today, is that the factions have kind of settled their quarrels and come together for the most
part. That's right.
And the whole idea of we're all clear on how lots of us were victims of the FBI's counterintelligence program targeting us and using every dirty trick in the book, to quote an FBI agent of 25 years who finally whistle blew on, you know, in Geronimo's case. So, anyway, I'm talking too much. Why don't you stop
there? No, you're talking good. You're giving us what we need to know. What was it like? I don't want to get too far ahead, but just on that first day when you went into the Panther office, you say in New Haven, what was it like? What was the sights, the sounds, and what did you experience?
Well, it wasn't, you know, like some kind of an entrance. I had been working for the so-called War on Poverty. And I was going to the evening meetings. I had my own. I mean, I wasn't getting paid to go to the evening meetings, but it was a period of time. They told me to go out in the community, organize in community, all right? There were seven communities, neighborhoods, that they had split up and pitted against each other and stuff. And I was in Newhallville, which was one of the black neighborhoods. And every time I was, we went to a meeting, practically Panthers were present. It was a meeting, a community meeting on education. If it was on health care, it was on, you know, whatever. But lead paint poisoning was a big issue at the time, and substandard housing and all kinds of issues that were going on. Community meetings, every time I went to one, Panthers were represented there. And I started seeing that they weren't getting paid, that they were volunteers, you know. And they were looking out and organizing the community. And when the Panthers called a huge meeting at the very facility at which I was employed, I went to the meeting, and you know, all the city of what would be attributed, would be called now a city council people, or pastors, and they shocked shit out. Excuse me, they shocked me when
are
they.
You all right?
Oh, I can do that?
Oh, absolutely. This is Black Power Radio.
Oh, I don't. It's not FCC?
No, not at all.
Oh, okay, cool.
Right ahead.
Well, they shocked the shit out of me when I realized that they voted against the Panthers. Let me backpedal. The Panthers had called a meeting to try to get a place for their breakfast program, a facility to run their breakfast program in the community. And this was my first introduction to the Panthers, because Belva, I think, was it Belva? Anyway, we knew her by Sister Love, and that's why I always have trouble with her name, because I think of her as Sister Love. She was only 16 years old, and she had been sent from Oakland, and along with a few others, of course, and but she was a spokesperson, and she was dynamite, and she convinced everyone to vote for the breakfast program, and it was housed in the same facility where I worked, and I loved the idea of it, and I was really amazed that clergy could publicly vote against a free breakfast program, okay? Anyway, the long and the short of it is, of this story, is that I started, along with others, let me put this a little more succinctly. A few of us began to understand what the government program was all about. And it was basically to set up little, what they call neighborhood corporations. And today you would call them nonprofits. It's almost the same soup warmed over, okay? Same old soup warmed over. And we began to understand that. So we saw how representatives of different neighborhoods began to notice, well, they're giving this group X number of dollars and that group more, that group less, you know, resources and so on, and pitting the neighborhoods against each other. So we started an organization. Some of the militants who had been working in the community long before me, and I got with some of them, you know, some of the veteran organizers of the community, and some of the other, you know, and we sat there, we got together, and we came up with seven together. Well, next thing I knew, I was out of a job, and I won't go into all that. First they fired me, I went over their heads, then because they had no grounds, and then they just chopped off the Community Action Institute, and I'm gone, and the next thing I know, I'm getting a call from the quote-unquote Urban League offering me a job for which I was completely unqualified, and which would have paid me more money than I've ever made in my life. Even working for IBM, an Arabian American oil company in New York City, okay? So
wow.
As a secretary. So I declined that and joined the party, and I already knew some of the party people. Oh, no. I know how it happened. Backpedal a little bit. Dougie Miranda and Robin Webb came to my house one day because we already knew each other from bumping heads and meetings and stuff. And so they came to recruit me into the party. And they had a little red book with them. And I fell in love with the red book and still keep one bedside. It's our little Bible. But anyway, dare to struggle, dare to win. That's Mao.
That's right.
A lot of slogans that were attributed to Huey were really Mao. But anyway, if the truth were known. But... the bottom line is serve the people, body and soul, straight up Mao. And people of the world, unite, defeat U.S. imperialism and all its running dogs.
That's right.
So there we. Anyway, when I joined the party, my pad became a Panther pad, and so that and everything that I owned became Panthers property,
okay.
Basically. We lived communally. I had a pad, in a little pad on Rock Creek Road. It was a duplex and had a nice big backyard and stuff. It was $80 a month. Think about the rents, the difference. In the 60s, you could actually pay rent in the 60s and have, you know, high ceilings and big rooms and stuff. It was amazing. The apartment that ultimately almost became Panther headquarters informally was... at Judson Avenue when it was a six-room pad with huge rooms and three bedrooms and shit. And two entrances and stuff, $160 a month, okay? But I could pay for it then because I had Charles Gary's salary, you see?
Okay.
So then, you know, Huey's whole entourage stayed there when he came out to visit, you know, to see about Huey and stuff. So that's how we met. But I had met him a year earlier when he first came out. That was 71 in February, I think.
Okay.
And Hilliard came with him. And he can verify what I'm talking about. Then when he first came out, and that picture that I have that Emery found, it didn't even have me named in it. He found it in a photo essay, some book somebody had. And he sent me a copy of it, and it had Elaine Brown under my name. And so that got corrected, also thanks to Larry Pinkney. That got corrected, and so I can have that picture. I actually had that picture a long, long time ago and lost it. So it was kind of nice to get it back. But
This was the picture of you and Minister Huey
and
the attorney?
It's on my blog spot.
Yes, ma'am, and they said they thought that was Elaine Brown instead of you.
It's in the book. It's in the photo essay of the Panthers, and it has Elaine Brown as me, and it even has the wrong place because I know where that picture was taken. The Koskovs gave a big bash, and you know I was young, and I remember the dress and shit.
Right on. Go ahead.
Governor, by the way. and it was Minnie. That was the style at the time, right? And the only reason I was even privileged to go to this particular bash at the Koskovs was because I had worked as a secretary for the Koskovs as well. Because Lonnie McLucas was the whole year of 1970 practically was Lonnie McLucas. Trial, well, a good portion of it, and he was sentenced to 4 years. He was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 4 years. And in the case. And I actually saw met him in New Haven when he got out and got to, you know, reunite with him very briefly. And where was that? We were talking about Bring Me Back.
You're talking about the bash.
Oh, yeah. I will never forget that one because, you know, like I said, the Costcos had a big old fat house in badass house in colonial style in the suburbs of Connecticut. I think it was Fairfield or something, but it was suburbs of Bridgeport. That's where their law offices were, and that's where I had to travel to work sometimes during the Lucas trial. I worked for them. So, and there were two. There was father and son, Ted Koskoff and Michael Koskoff. So Ted, I'm sure, is gone. He was elderly then. So the house was beautiful. And, I mean, they were barbecuing in thick steaks. I'm a vegetarian now, so it wouldn't interest me. But at that time, wow. and all the big heavyweights were there, including, I think, Tom Hayden was there and some of the other, I can't remember them, but anyway, all the hierarchy of the party was there, and, you know, well, I shouldn't say hierarchy, should I? I should say Central Committee.
Central Committee?
Like
that's right.
They kind of behaved in an elitist kind of way sometimes, some of them. But anyway, I won't go there.
Yes, ma'am.
But I'm an egalitarian to the bone, you know. People try to call me queen and goddess, and let me straighten that out right now.
You heard me correct myself. I tried to catch it. That's right. Go right ahead.
I am straight up egalitarian, mm-hmm. and I'm a Maoist in this, very much in this sense. I believe in plain living and hard struggle. And Camrys went into Mao's pad after, you know, which is preserved after his death. And it's plainer than my little old project apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, hardwood floors, a big old armchair, wall-to-wall books, floor-to-ceiling books, you know.
That's what I'm talking about.
The bedroom was a big double bed, looked real comfy, and hardwood floors and a bureau.
still a
drawer.
Still got a Panther pad.
He practiced what he preached, and that's why I so admired him, because the people of China were starving to death. They had forced to sell their children prior to the revolution. And so he understood. And the first thing, nobody, his enemies could not deny that Mao fed China. His leadership fed China. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that had been starving to death and kicked out all the Western imperialists in Japan, too. So
that's right.
What's not to respect?
Exactly. Exactly.
And all these same people that these same enemies that denounce him today, their fathers and grandfathers beat a path to him. I used to have a weekly subscription to Peking Review. It was Peking Review, and every week prior to his death in 1976. He died. He had Parkinson's too, prior to his death, and he was 82 when he passed. And every king, president, prime minister, whatever else they call themselves, head of state in the world, beat a path to try to see Mao to say that they had met the man before he died.
Mm.
And these same ones, I'm old enough to know, will denigrate the hell out of him today. But I was in the hospital when he passed, and I read every magazine, everything I could get my hands on.
Mm-hmm.
And the man was amazing.
Well, why do you think that is?
And he liberated Chinese women.
Sister Keeley, why do you think that is? Not even just in the case of Chairman Mao, But in the case of many leaders and many of our great ones, that even in the case of the Panther formation of the 60s and the breakfast programs, you had so many who benefited from many of the programs and much of the leadership, and then in today's time they would disrespect the legacy, or they will, you know, talk bad about the leadership. Why do you think that is?
Well, in today's real world, there is no freedom of speech.
Okay.
I mean, you've seen journalists who are, you know, establishment journalists step out of line a little bit to tell the truth.
Right.
And they're gone.
That's right.
And
that's true.
I've been paying pretty close attention for a very long time, and while I was hospitalized for years on end, you know, I pulled a George. You know, I couldn't do this 1,000 finger dip push-ups a day, but I sure could study.
Right, right.
And read, because
right.
He wrote to me one letter. He told me, he said, that I never did do that well. I couldn't be George. I tried. But he said, I read 6 dailies and several books a week.
Wow.
And he sent me a book list as if to say, hey, catch up, here, catch up. I think I'm still trying to catch up.
Put you on assignment, huh?
And that's 41 years after he hasn't studied anymore.
Man.
Okay. He was so far ahead of me. George was a bookworm before, and when he was in juvenile, they teased him for being a bookworm.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to fight probably because of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, but
I know something about
it. And that's when he really started studying and getting down with Marx and, you know, and how he talks about that, how Marx and Engels and Mao and Nkrumah and Fanon, you know. I'm a Maoist,
yes,
Fanonist, he said one time.
Absolutely.
Hans Fanon, author of Wretched of the Earth, who, for those who don't know, who
right.
switched sides when the French sent him from Martinique to fight the colonial war against the Algerian independence movement, and he switched sides and wrote Wretched of the Earth in the process.
That's right.
He was a surgeon, I think. No,
yes,
he was,
ma'am.
He was a psychiatrist too, wasn't he?
Psychiatrist.
Psychiatrist.
Yes, ma'am, a psychiatrist. Uh-huh.
One of the first books
at the...
that I read when I was in New Haven, and I was a Panther, was, and probably we were assigned, Black Skin, White Mask.
White Mask. That's right.
Yeah, that was the
yes.
That was a real eye opener.
Yes, ma'am. I'm looking at, I don't know if you had, you remember the one called A Dying Colonialism. You remember that one? France
yes.
Fanon?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am. That's the one I'm dealing with now with him. You kind of touched on General George a little bit. I want to back you up. Some you got so much information. I don't want the listening audience to miss any. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about Minister Huey P. Newton, what he was like, what was like being around him, his personality? Many of our audience were, you know, a different generation. We didn't get that chance. So can you kind of tell us a little bit about it?
Whoa, wow, that's a tough one.
That's right.
I have to first preface what I'm about to say with, I didn't have an opportunity to spend much time with him.
Okay.
Okay. That said, and I also think, he was hero worshipped a bit much. And,
yes, ma'am.
And we've got to be careful of that. And it's a good lesson for us to learn. We shouldn't put people up on pedestals. We should be egalitarians and understand that we all have flaws and that we all make mistakes. And
that's
that
right.
Things are in a constant state of change, and if people don't keep up with the change, they get left behind and then they make wrong decisions and wrong
yes,
analyses.
Ma'am.
So that said, Huey Newton, when I first met him at the party, I just fell in love. I'm just not going to lie. Everybody, and I wasn't the only one, everybody was in love. And I could see all the forces at work making sure that we didn't get together, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, yeah. The green-eyed monster was all over the place.
Okay? All right.
So I said, damn, you know, he's fine. And he was fresh out of prison. He was gorgeous. And,
mm-hmm.
And he was shy. He was soft-spoken and very shy, and that surprised me. And and he was just so sweet. It just very soft-spoken. And so I was totally smitten. But the next time he came, the People's Committee, I was working for the People's Committee, and we had a meeting, and I had foreman and auxiliary so that I could include anybody who wanted to work, which meant they could be any color and any status. And we had welfare moms with Yale couples with Yale students, with Yale professors' housewives, and you know, they wanted to do stuff. So I got them together and formed a People's Committee. So and they met when Donald Freed, who was working. They either met at my house or they met at Donald Freed's place because he came to write a book entitled The Agony of New Haven, which is still available. And I got to know him because he used to invite me to dinner a lot, and I didn't mind accepting. And his house was close to the courthouse. And, of course, I'm working for Gary, and he invited Gary because Gary was out of town staying in a room at Yale with no cooking facilities. So he had Gary to dinner regularly, so he'd invite me too, and I got him to have People's Committee meetings at the house, at his house, because he had a much bigger, nicer bed and refreshments and everything. The People's Committee was trying to decide where Huey would stay when he came to town, We contacted all the black ministers, and they wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole. So I said, well, if push comes to shove, he can always stay at my pad, because I had like a pad I described earlier, was just three bedrooms. And the Florence were right next door. Ann and John Florence, one of the Chicago Seven that used to be Eight, that was originally Eight with Bobby Seale, came and set up housekeeping in New Haven to campaign for Bobby's freedom. So they lived right next to me, and Ann Freund and I got tight because she was the real, you know, worker, you know, as most of the women were. And we're the ones, she and I laid out the tabloid that went out, you know, Bobby and Erica must be free, on her dining room table, okay? But so I went next door when Huey's, obviously the pastors didn't do it. Nobody would touch him, so he did. His whole entourage stayed at my pad, Hilliard and him, and several other Panthers, and Marty Kenner, who wasn't a Panther but was running behind Huey. So, and I stayed next door, and I just gave him the whole pad. And so when I came back the next morning to fix breakfast for everybody and stuff, you know, that's when I got really acquainted with Huey, but I noticed a distinct difference. And at that point, he was very nervous, and he was very and jittery, and he couldn't sit down more than 5 minutes. He was pacing, and he was a very different personality than the one I had met in 70, and this is 71.
Okay.
So I won't go any further than that, except, well, I have to a little bit if I tell the truth. At one point, I was at his pad in at Yale, and Hilliard was there, and Connie Matthews was there, and I was there. And Connie Matthews was his secretary, and may she rest in peace. She died of cancer very prematurely. Huey was angry with her. She was a little tipsy when we came back, and I could see that there were serious problems in that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And she along with her husband Michael Setueo Tabor, went underground, split from the party. As a matter of fact, during that period when they were staying at my house. No, or was it later? No, then. I forgot.
Okay.
Anyway. Huey got rough on her. She wanted to leave, and he wouldn't let her. And God kind of, they kind of picked her up bodily and kind of roughed her into the other room. And I stood up to leave. Because this is me. If I can't defend somebody, I just leave. I'm not going to sit there and watch somebody be abused. And I'm going to register my protest in one way or another.
Right.
And usually it's as a young woman, it was usually walking out. And that's what I did that time. And prior to that, he had tested me a little bit. And I had already told him I don't know karate, but I know crazy.
No, that's right.
And in a very serious tone, not joking. So
right.
He left me alone and went on to mess with Connie again, and I just stood up to leave. But I learned there were, as Charles Gary even noted when he was interviewed, there were two Hueys. There was the one that got screwed up on cocaine, and I have a feeling that all that jittery hyper stuff, and the rumors were already out that he had gotten hooked up on cocaine. And fast forward to when he went to see Geronimo, and I beat him to have to visit Geronimo again after he was there because I wanted to know what happened.
Right.
And so Geronimo told me that, you know, they set it up so because they thought that they were going to kick each other's ass. It was going to be a fight. You know, because you know Huey abandoned Geronimo when he was on trial.
Yes, ma'am.
So the bottom line is Geronimo went over and embraced the man, took the high ground, and he told me directly, he said, Huey said, and of course I have to paraphrase, he said he basically couldn't resist all the sugar-coated bullets, as we used to call them. He said they offered him everything, cocaine, and believe me, I know the rap about cocaine because it was offered to me left and right, and I tried it once and didn't like it. They kept saying it was no more harmful, no more addictive than smoking marijuana.
Okay, gotcha.
That was the rap that came when it was first introduced into our black communities, okay? I know how easy it was to get hooked on that.
Right.
They liked it. I'm lucky. You know, there but for the grace, you know. So
right.
And it was too damn expensive. I wasn't paying that much money for nothing.
Right. Right.
So in any case, we had already had rumors that he had $300 a day habit and shit like that. But when back to the conversation, Huey said to Geronimo, he said they offered the Hollywood starlets, you know, and he was gorgeous. Hollywood starlets, everything, money. They set him up in that penthouse. That's when a lot of us start getting pissed off because we were living hand to mouth, you know.
Right.
You know, everything we could beg, borrow, and steal because we weren't working. We were working full-time for the people. You know,
right.
Maybe
right.
one or two of us here and there had a full-time job so that just to bring in income, some money that we didn't have to beg, borrow, or steal. You know, mm-hmm. We pulled welfare checks. That's one of the ways we did it. We pulled our AFDC checks and stuff. But we were barely mm-hmm. making it, you know. And then
right.
when we started getting all the news that the Panthers are in the East, in the East, we started getting all the news that the Panthers in the West are living high on the hog and penthouses and, you know, driving around. Huey was driving around a chauffeur-driven this, chauffeur-driven. Hey! What I think really happened, and here's the analysis that I have. Just as the ANC has its left wing and its right wing.
Right.
Okay? The Black Panther Party had its left wing and its right wing.
Makes a lot of sense.
Now, the left wing, the right wing went back to church, back to the electoral politics. And back to making money and back to basically being capitalistic.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense.
The other, the left went underground or kept trying to be, I was never trusted, I'm too damn light, of you two have been trusted to go underground, right? But that's another story. But in any case, we need to stop with this color struck crap. But getting back to, because I watched dark-skinned FBI agents getting up on the stand in the two trials testifying against Lonnie and Bobby and Erica, okay?
Right.
And on cross-examination, they had instigated robberies, mud holings, what they used to call beatings, which they had no business doing in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, I know about...
Yes.
That, well... Bring
yes,
back
yes, ma'am. You putting it on us. You giving the people what we need, because I'm saying, like I said, a lot of this new generation, us new generation, we need this, so we don't get tripped up.
I'm going to bring it down from new generation. Dare to struggle, but what is struggle? Struggle is work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, work is struggle. Struggle is work. Work is struggle. Struggle is work. You're unemployed. You shouldn't be laying around talking about I ain't got nothing to do, I'm bored.
No, that's right. Teach.
I don't want to hear it. I am never bored.
Go ahead.
Okay. How am I going to be bored when there's so much to do?
Go ahead.
Okay.
That's right.
All your neighbors are well taken care of? All the kids in your neighborhood are well taken care of? Nobody's hurting. Nobody needs nothing. There are no elderly hurting that don't have to go, can't make it to the store and couldn't even eat that day because they couldn't get to the store. There's no sick people that might need some help because they can't afford anything medical.
That's right.
This rotten medical system is horrible.
That's right.
Do you know what I had to do today? And one of the reasons I'm sounding kind of angry because I had an interview with the housing authority. I'm living in the Pinyon projects because they claimed that the only place they could find for me was the projects in Chinatown when I battled my way out of one of their nasty nursing homes. Okay, so I could raise my child. And I believe in plain living hard struggle.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a problem with me. I know how to be poor.
Right.
We know how to be poor. I've been poor ever since I walked out of Sun Reporter and said, I'm not working for no more fascists, no more capitalists.
I feel you.
Okay?
I feel you. Go ahead.
No matter what color they are, you hear me?
Right.
I'm not paying no more taxes to finance their military monster.
Right.
And oppress us.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
That's real talk. Go ahead. That's right.
I've been working for the people since 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud of that. I don't have no credentials like other people, so nobody invites me and gives me $500 for a speech and shit.
They should.
Save trips. Because first of all, they don't want to hear what I got to say.
I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying, but they should, though. Go ahead.
You got to bring me back, because, I know what I was talking about. I had to fill out a quarter-inch thick bunch of forms. Every year it gets a bit thicker and thicker. And I thought that was all and went down to the – she gave that to me, the office assistant office manager in the building. This is a high-rise project building with about 94 units in it, and I'm in one of them. And so I go downstairs. I pass by the office. She hands me this quarter-inch thick, you got to fill this out. Well, now they got one for people with disabilities. It's special now. So I spend half the morning filling this thing out. Then I go down for the appointment, and she's got 20 more of the regular ones. I thought, this is a new deal. No, she's got 20 more forms. All I do is sign. Oh, this is all to stay in the projects now. Public housing.
Ridiculous.
Okay. So
it's crazy.
Okay, and you should see what they want from you. And I didn't have my, I forgot my bank statement, so I got to make sure. And I don't have a savings account. I only have a checking account. But I have to take my checking account statement to her, okay? And I have, guess what? The rules are you cannot have somebody stay in your apartment more than 2 weeks. Now, I'm just,
right.
I am completely disabled now, especially since the last surgery. So I can't get out of a bed and out of a chair, and I use a motorized wheelchair for mobility. I need somebody here.
Absolutely.
Okay? And I do have someone here, but if I, and I can't have somebody here, so I just committed fraud today.
We know what you're, we know what you're saying, Mama Kilo. Okay.
I am now, no, I want to make sure that everybody understands that Obama would not prosecute any of the Bush crimes of torture, okay, and violation of human rights, okay, egregious violations of human rights, right?
Right.
These banks ripped us off for trillions.
Trillions.
Nobody has gotten anything more than a fine that if you and I would have to pay it out of our incomes, it would be like giving us a $5 fine.
That's right.
Millionaires.
Good teach.
Give them
right.
a whole million-dollar
right.
fine and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But now if I say, if I have somebody living with me so I don't have to live in a $100,000 a year nursing home,
teach.
Medical prison, I can stay out here and function in service and serve the people too, and be and contribute to society, living independently, right? No.
Right.
No, I'm a felon. You hear me? I'm a felon. The thing I put on that application is not correct. 20 pages or something.
You.
Anything is incorrect, I'm a felon.
Right.
And all that that means, and you and I both know what that means. That means you're disenfranchised as a voter. Possibly.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You can't get a job. You can't get credit. You can't get this. You can't get that. I'm 73 and don't give a fuck. You know?
Right. Right on.
You know, but what about the people? I'm speaking for the people who are in the same boat as me, only they're not
right.
73.
Right.
They might be 23. They might
exactly.
be 33. Do you feel
That's
me?
Right. That's
but
absolutely.
They're disabled and need to have somebody there with them in the house.
Right. Right. That's right. I didn't want you to necessarily put your own cat out the bag, but you know, you don't give a damn. So I mean, Mama Kilo, you know,
doesn't really become real until it actually is real.
Right.
This is not something I read in a book. I'm not passing on some hearsay.
I know it.
So there you have it.
That's real talk.
Now
that's
when
real
we talk,
talk.
We go back to George, and he said when they talk recession, we're already in a Great Depression.
Exactly. Can you talk to us a little bit about General George? We've got a lot of brothers and sisters on the line that you know that adhere on a daily to books like Solidaire, Brother Blood in My Eye. It's a way of life. Can you talk to us a little bit about your experiences? I know you talked about the letters, but talk to us a little bit about the times in the waiting room and things that you had with General George Jackson.
Well, I think he would prefer. Well, maybe he would be. Yeah, he probably wouldn't mind being called General.
it's fitting. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I was so anxious to meet him. I got up there to the prison, and believe me, it was horrible running into those. They were straight-up redneck racists. I mean, redneck might not be the correct term, but they were the kind that you can almost smell their racism, you know, Ku Klux Klan types. You know, they're
right.
red-faced just looking at you. Or
That's
don't
right.
won't
mm-hmm.
look at you with shit. But, ooh, goodness, it was awful going up there. They were so mean, and they were so... Ooh. And I got up there, and I was a whole week early. So I had to go back the next week. But anyway, I got a whole hour, 1 hour in July of 71. I will never forget. And the two of us sat there puffing smoke in each other's face. They put us in this little holding cell that was actually, it wasn't a visiting room, but it was contact. I mean, we could manage to, I could stand up on a chair and hug him and then get back down and sit. And then there was this little opening where we could blow smoke in each other's face and, you know, that kind of thing. But we just talked. We really talked. We had a lot to talk about, and we were talking about the party and stuff and what was going on. And it's still a little emotional for me.
Yes,
I can't
ma'am.
Believe it, but even 41 years later, you know. George was just... I was 32, and he would have been 30 a month after they killed him. He was born September 23rd, 1941, and I'm 39, May 22nd. And he was so far ahead of most people, myself included. And at that point in my young life, I had not met a man. I met lots of men who I thought were intellectually, you know, pretty together, you know, were intelligent and stuff and loved to talk to them, you know, egghead types, you know. And I enjoyed mm-hmm. talking to them, but I always kept them as my brothers, you know what I mean, you know, play brother.
Right, right.
Because they weren't attractive. And
right.
And then there was what Eldridge described as a super masculine menial. <You know>? That, you know, all brawn, no brains, you know?
Right,
or at least
right.
no intellect, you know, they're not using their brains, they're not exercising their brains. And but when I realized George was, well, in our correspondence, I never even tripped on him in any other way except intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw him, it blew me away because the first time I saw him was in the courtroom. And
okay.
My goodness gracious, I said, Lord.
Go ahead.
I couldn't believe it because I wasn't expecting it. You know, the picture on the Soledad, cover of Soledad Brothers, the only one I had. And he just looks like, you know, with his horn-rimmed glasses, just looks like an egghead. But then he was fine. He was built like a brick, you know what. And so... I just had never met both put together in one package, okay?
Okay.
Mind and body, and then all that love, you know, mm-hmm. because he really loved people. That's what he was motivated by. And mm-hmm. it's all through his book, you know. He said to me one time, and I'll share this with you, I don't think I've ever done this on, or have I, on radio. there was one line that I've lost his letters, and some of them I are retained in the spread that I did in the immediate wake of his death. I was the editor of the Sun Reporter and did the first four responsible for the first four pages in August 71, and they can be found in UC Berkeley. I know the archives, but the title, the name would be Pat Galeo, because I was Pat Galeo then. And,
yes, ma'am.
And some of the letters he wrote to me are contained in the articles. Everybody was familiar with Soledad Brothers, so I took some quotes from letters that he had written me. Like one of them was "Action makes the front," The other one was, well, in a personal letter he wrote to me, and of course I wouldn't put that in the Sun Reporter at that time. But, and I'm 73, I can say shit like this now. But
right, that's right. You heard that.
I'm about to say kind of puts it in a nutshell who he was. He said, "Woman, after the people have eaten, you will be loved on."
Hmm. That's heavy.
It just stuck in my brain like glue. I've never forgotten it. But the people
after
were
the
always...
people have eaten.
After the people have eaten. Mm-hmm. You know, if you read his writings, you'll get the flow of how he expresses himself.
Oh, yeah.
You know. And, you know, I that just stuck in my mind, like I said. It's just there forever, you know. But I really got it. And you know, and in another letter he wrote to me, you know, when I had Michael with me when I saw him in the courtroom, and I think he was a little taken aback by Michael being such a big kid, because he was 71, 11, okay? And
wow.
He wrote to me after that, and he said, well, what will you do with him? And I said, Michael has more TE than I do. He's been in the party. We taught our kids TE, technical education, because we weren't going to have them around guns without knowing how to use them and how to break them down, the safety of, you know, and the whole. They got schooled, okay?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
You're right.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, but George, a very amazing man.
Blew you away.
May I share with you a quote from Soledad Brother? Because in my paper you can find lots of quotes. Most of them are from A Blood in My Eye, with maybe one or two exceptions, okay?
Absolutely. Yes,
but this kind of explains his ideology, okay? And it's on page 224 of the original Soledad Brother, with the introduction by Jean Genet, who came to New Haven and spoke at rallies for Bobby Seale, too, by the way.
Okay.
Here we go. Quote, dialectical materialism. Oh, God. Somebody's out. Did you hear the horrible noises? That's traffic. It sounds like I'm in traffic, but I'm not. I'm up on the ninth floor, and the sound carries. Okay, here we go.
You all right? You all right? We live. Go right ahead.
No. Dialectical materialism is my bag. I identify with anyone who hates just one fascist. I don't want a piece of the pie. I don't want all of it, even. I think it's rotten, should be discarded. We should start all over again. This new start should be made without individualism. And then he has these parentheses. Read isolation. Mysticism, read religion. With a modification of the language for the purpose of removing the concept of possession, read capitalism. Without the hard hat mentality, read William F. Buckley, Playboy, Central Intelligence Agency.
Teach.
Okay.
Teach.
That's George.
That's,
you know?
That's straight up. That's straight up. Tell us a little bit, and I don't want to leave that point, but your thoughts on his brother, Jonathan Jackson. He 17 years old.
Oh, amazing. Just amazing. He quotes him extensively in Blood in My Eye.
That's right.
I mean, come on. I mean, this young brother was George's brother. I mean, you know, in the full sense of brother.
Mm-hmm.
The political sense of brother, not just blood brother.
Okay.
Okay. And the thing that people need to understand was the truth that fell out after, you know, years later was this. Now, I can even tell you who told me. Warren Wells, who went to the hospital from San Quentin, was taken from the hospital, from San Quentin to the hospital because he had, I think, something wrong with his liver or something, and wound up having a heart attack in the hospital. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Right. Right.
But he had been a Panther, and I was writing to him, and he told me, he said that, and he wrote me a letter, and he sent me some information, and he said, Jonathan was not supposed to be alone. In fact, he was one of the ones who was supposed to be with the guerrillas, except that day they didn't let him go to court for some reason. I forgot. But he said that he Jonathan was supposed to have plenty of company with him.
Right.
He was not supposed to be there alone. And,
that's right.
But he was so brave and so courageous that he just said, fuck it, I'm going to do this. And he
right.
he went in there armed to the teeth, and the rest is history, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean,
mm-hmm.
for those who really don't know, the idea was to go to a radio station and expose the murders, the periodic murders, the systemic murders
right.
of black and black prisons particularly, because the Mexicans
mm-hmm.
at that time, you know, that the if you read Dorothy Roberts' book, she details this of how they categorize some of the quote unquote brown folks by giving them the opportunity to be white. You know,
mm.
and they co-opted them that way and pitted them against blacks. So
okay.
So and that's what they did.
Just like today,
they pitted Mexicans.
Okay.
They kind of allied them with whites and pitted both groups against blacks.
Yes, ma'am.
So it would, you know, Sundi will tell you that's all you could hear on the air was nigga, 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 and he said it just
mm-hmm.
like that. You know,
mm-hmm.
it was horrible for blacks in those days, and you had to watch your back all the time, you know. And so Fred Billingsley had just been murdered in February of 71, and of course you know that W.L. Nolan and Sweet Jugs Miller and Cleve Edwards had been killed January the prior 70. Okay, now February 71, Frederick Billingsley was murdered in his cell and tear gassed to death. Okay?
Okay, right.
So a guard was retaliated against by James McClain, and he was on trial, okay, when Jonathan stormed the courtroom. Okay? And William Christmas and James McClain were the two who were supposed to join that move to go to a radio station and advertise, announce to the world, take over the radio station, announce, you know, with the judge, the prosecutor, three jurists hostage. They were supposed,
mm-hmm.
and the brothers were supposed to keep them hostage, and they were supposed to also take over the radio station and broadcast to the world the conditions, the murders, and demand the release of the Soledad brothers by noon or something like that. By a certain
okay.
time, anyway.
And uh-huh.
But Jonathan never got out of the parking lot because the San Quentin pigs arrived and shot it up. And the judge
right.
was killed, a juror was wounded, a prosecutor was paralyzed for life, Rochelle was seriously wounded and unconscious, and Jonathan and Christmas were dead. And
right.
William Christmas and James McClain were dead.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. What do you think it is? And I'm just asking this for the listening audience. And Jonathan Jackson, 17 years old. Many of the comrades you talked about previously were youngsters. What do you think the breakdown has been between our youngsters of today and maybe the youngsters of yesterday?
Wow. Well, the social climate of today and, you know, environment shapes people. No
mm-hmm.
doubt. I'm a social scientist, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
And
mm-hmm.
The social environment today is so much more reactionary. The media is so much more reactionary.
Yes, it is.
That, and the revolving door prison system in which they literally manufacture criminals. Okay, because if you weren't a criminal when you go into prison and you're not political or conscious, you'll probably be a criminal by the time you come out.
That's right.
Okay. And
mm-hmm.
This is a tough, tough period to organize in. And
mm-hmm.
there are people who are very, very receptive to the truth because they recognize it instantly. They've suffered so much already.
Mm-hmm.
and they unfreedom so long that they'll hear the truth. They'll know the truth when they hear it. But how can we get it to them? They're never, you know, I mean, it's very, very, there are small openings now, you know, here and there. But the mainstream media is a monster. It's owned by a small handful of corporate fascists. You know, General Electric is the ones that, they're the ones who own nuclear plants and stuff.
That's right.
So, you know, we're in the mainstream, they never were as mendacious, as lying and untruthful as they are today. Back in the 60s. I mean, David Hillion and Kathleen Cleaver could get on the mainstream news, ABC or some shit, and talk stuff, you know?
Right, and break it down.
They could even get on, you know, talk shows like, what was that guy that they ran out of the, they used to have a talk show, it won't come to me. But, what's his name? He used to have a regular, and they got rid of him because he would interview revolutionaries and people.
Talking about Brother Gil Noble?
No, he's earlier, and he's European American.
Okay.
I can't think of his name. Very, very popular. Very well known, but maybe you're too young to remember him. In any case, he used to have a lot of all kind of folks, you know. And then, you know, Jack Parr, that really dates me. He would have James Baldwin and people like that on his show, you know, Sly Stone, who would say anything. But that's not happening anymore.
Sure isn't.
I mean, I'll never forget seeing Kathleen Cleaver on TV. I was saying to myself, wow, she can represent me any day.
Right.
I was so tired of the mammies representing black women, you know?
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
Yeah, come on, but not today. Today they have a whole new kind of colored person that they can put before you, you know, that is so whitened politically and culturally, that you're not going to know the difference, except that they're going to be very attractive and brown-skinned, you know.
Yes,
but they'll come at you with terrible politics, lots of untruth, and, you know, all kinds of scandal, and we'll drink the Kool-Aid, you know. Unfortunately, that's happened with the Obamas. They're a lovely family. Mm-hmm. They're all beautiful. And they've completely enamored most of black America. And
we
have always been in the forefront of American history struggles, always.
That's right.
Even the Revolution.
That's right.
Or, okay, we have always been in the forefront, you know, and in the vanguard, if you will. But
that's right.
We have laid down and died since Obama, since what, 2008?
2008.
We have just laid down. And we've let
this great teaching.
We've let this government just run amok. They're killing blacks every so often now that you can't even keep up with the numbers anymore. I can't keep up with the murders anymore.
I can't either.
I'm like a reporter, and, you know, I try to, you know, I'm a... not a reporter exactly, but a journalist, you know.
That's right.
And I'm
That's
always
right.
trying to learn new truth and put truth out. I can't keep up anymore. There's so
right.
many murders all over the country of black people. You know, police.
It really is.
You know, and then, you know, they're dropping drones all over Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen.
Right, right.
You know, Egypt,
right.
you name it. Everywhere
in Syria, that's right.
Syria now, this is they're getting ready to take Syria, and the next thing you know, they're going to move. They're planning to move on Iran as we speak. It's insane.
That's real.
You see, but I'm old enough to remember what happened in Iran in the first damn place, and how they took a democratically elected people's leader, Mossadegh, out and installed the Shah. back in, put the Shah back in after the people had gotten rid of that royal, that evil royal royalty,
right.
And so-called
right.
royalty, and the people finally got rid of him, you know, and they haven't let them rest yet, you know.
Mm.
They just it's oil rich. It's that simple.
Right.
Wants your damn oil, fuck you. We're going to take your oil. And
exactly.
A lot of people are very mistaken about Gaddafi.
Uh-huh.
Fell in love with Gaddafi in 1969. Are you kidding me? He was fine. He was all that. He took over, kicked the U.S. naval base out, and all the imperialists the hell out of there, and started feeding the people, came up with the green, I got a copy of the Green Book and everything.
That's right.
But in 2003, I started seeing his craziness, you know,
okay.
signs of it along the way.
Uh-huh.
Okay, as a lot of people did, and just kind of, you know, ignored it and, you know, let it slide, well, nobody's perfect kind of attitude, you know. And mm-hmm. then finally, in 2003, he capitulated, and that's when I was through mm-hmm. with him. Because he did,
right.
you know, it just came out very recently how much, you know, I read at one point that he owned something like 5% of the Italian economy. He had $5 billion in Italian banks. They found, discovered after, I don't know how many billions, so don't quote that, but billions in Italian banks they found out after his a while after he was killed. Okay?
Mm.
He had completely... People talk about, oh, they bombed Libya to get the oil. No, honey, they already had the oil. All the Western... He had oil contracts with everybody.
Mm.
Not that he wasn't
then.
Making super profits, and his kids were partying in France all over the place. They were totally his son scandalous. Totally scandalous.
And so you think it just came back to...
But they had a $10 million house that they owned in London, and some British youngsters, radicals, occupied it. Yes, that's how I learned about
wow.
it. Okay?
Wow.
You're
dropping it. You're dropping it first. Go ahead. I won't cut you off.
We have to be careful of icons.
Yes, ma'am.
Individuals. We have to stick to the principle, not the personality. That goes for
yes,
Hughes.
Ma'am.
That goes for Gaddafi. That goes for any leader. That goes for Jesse Jackson. I once thought he was all that. Ha. Huh. Okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Things are in a constant state of change. I always allow for people who have messed up in the past. If I see them again, you know, 10, 15 years later, I allow for change. Is the change positive? Is it negative? Is it...
Yes, ma'am.
...actionary? Did they move further to toward fascism and into the system? Or did they
right.
move further toward revolution, resistance?
That's it. That's it. Mama Kalu, we got to take some calls. We got some callers I want to talk to. Start here. We got a Deputy National Field Marshal of the Party, Sister Nadia Shakur. She has a question for you. Area code 770. You're on the air with Black Power Radio. Mama Kalu and Yasha, your question, your comment. Black Power.
Yes, sir. Power to the people, comrade. Mr. Comrade, first, I just want to give you revolutionary salutes. I appreciate your continued sacrifice and steadfast adherence to the theory. I'm following your footsteps. I have a question to you about Blood in My Eyes, because this is a book that I study extensively. I consider myself a revolutionary socialist intercommunalist, but I'm a Joyce Jacksonian until I die, Queen. So I want to ask you, how do you feel about
I'm
the
I'm not a queen. Sister.
Yes, ma'am.
Sister.
Call her sister.
Queen is hierarchy. I'm a sister.
I'm sorry,
right.
sister. It's a habit. But, sister, how do you feel about the relevancy of Blood in My Eye today as far as our economic, political, and military theory and how we organize our people?
Wow. Great question, sister. All right. Yes, I think it's amazing how on target it is today. I really think it's amazing. But the second thing is that as far as tactics and strategy and tactics, we always have to be clear that strategy and tactics is always dependent on conditions. And George was clear on that himself. So
yes,
he would know that we could not use the same exact strategies and tactics in the 21st century in 2012 as we were using in the 20th century in 1970 or 71, okay?
Because yes, ma'am.
Are not the same. We didn't even have computers then. You know, we
yes,
couldn't
ma'am.
Tweet. We couldn't email. We couldn't Facebook. You know, and the Egyptian Revolution relied heavily on the new technology.
That's right.
You know, it didn't make the revolution, but it helped a great deal. It helped facilitate the revolutionary movement, okay? And it will help facilitate the ongoing struggle because they got a lot of work to do, and we should keep watching that struggle because we can learn from the mistakes they're making. As
yes,
you
ma'am.
Watch. But getting back to what you were saying, to answer your question, you had several parts, and one was military. I don't think now is the time for military action. And one of the benefits of Jonathan Jackson's bravery, of his courage, is that what did he learn? He learned, and it came out in trial, that had he taken 20 women and children hostage, they would have still shot up the van. They would have all been dead. They asked that question to one of the guards. Would you still shoot to kill? Absolutely. They're dead from the time that they take the hostages. They're dead. So he sacrificed his life so that we won't use that tactic again. It doesn't work. They don't give a damn about the judge, the jurors, nobody. They don't care. They're dead. So that's a good lesson. However, and we've seen subsequent lessons on what it means to go up against a military machine that has expanded and proliferated as enormously as this one has. And when we were Panthers, there were 41 field officers. God only knows how many field offices there are today, but I bet you it's triple at least, and the number. And they're using drones as tiny as a spider now for surveillance, you know. And like Miles said, fight no battles you can't win. So we have to learn how to fight anew, how to fight battles we know we can win. And that's a tough nut to crack. And I have faith in the youth. I have faith in young people because I know y'all will create y'all audacious and high energy, and you'll figure out how to fight and win. Fight winning battles, because when you fight battles that you know you're going to lose and you lose, then you're telling the people you can't win. Your message is...
Yes, ma'am. I understand, sister. Let me ask you a follow-up question to that. George teaches us in Blood in My Eye that revolutionary struggle and consciousness is a process of exhausting all other processes of struggle, the electoral process and electoral politics and such. So... If we can see you on with this theory that revolution is constantly growing, and we understand what phase of fascism we're in now, what phase do you see that we're in as far as exhausting all other means of struggle, and we're in the year of a new electoral process, and we have the position of voting back in the neocolonial puppet again? So using all this that we know, sister, where do you see that we are now as far as the revolutionary process?
Well, I think you're mistaken, if I heard you correctly, sister, George was very much against, he was clear on electoral politics. He said an electoral choice between 10 different fascists is like choosing which way one wishes to die.
Exactly, exactly.
So, I haven't voted for anybody since Kennedy, and I live to regret that. I don't think that we should participate in this. And he also said that and I'm not sure which book it was from or whether it was from a letter or whatever, but I remember he said that most agree that the first step is withdrawal from the enemy system, withdrawal from the fascist system.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. I withdrew, okay? And I work outside of the system. And I've caught hell for it, and it's not easy, but I work outside of the system. I don't pay any taxes, at least not income taxes. We're all stuck with some taxes, but I don't pay any income taxes to this mother. And so I think those are the first things. And I actually think that the best thing we can do, and he talks about this too, is develop revolutionary culture. And when I'm not just talking about singing songs and raps. I'm talking about becoming the new man, the new woman, like Yogi still talks about, you know, Ugo Pinel. Because and in the process of becoming the new woman and the new man, you're going to become an advocate of plain living and hard struggle, simple living, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Not living high on the hog and sharing and caring. And if you share, you're not going to have much because, you know, that's the nature of the beast. When you share, and you have to live simply, okay? And the bottom line is you also take care of the people around you. Grace Lee Boggs has a lot to say about that, and she's worked organizing in Detroit. You know, put the neighbor back in the hood, she says.
That's right.
And she's right. Put the neighbor back in the hood. Start organizing community gardens. This economy is going to worsen. I strongly believe all the handwriting is on the wall that it's going to get worse. And
absolutely,
we're going to be like one of those Latin American oligarchies. And so we better learn how to share and how to be poor, because we all going to be poor. Ain't going to be no damn middle class. We're going to all be poor. And I already know how, so I'm not worried. But people have
right on.
Get ready. You better get ready to share. And I mean share. And you might have to buck some housing authority rules that don't allow you to take somebody homeless into your home. Okay? But it's time to do that. Okay? It's time to move people into stop these foreclosures and stop these people from coming and taking people out of their houses and making them homeless.
Yes,
when I
ma'am.
Was a Panther, we organized rent strikes, and I actually was participating in organizing a rent strike at the Housing Authority, and believe me, they got me back later on. But the bottom line is you can't organize a rent strike today because it's not about substandard housing. Everybody's scared to death to go on a rent strike or anything because the bottom line is they're scared the landlord just kick them out. So,
right, get evicted, right.
The issue is homelessness. Do you know what Berkeley is doing right now? There was a demonstration where they got a new slogan. They're saying the right to sleep. Because they've got a sit-lie ordinance in Berkeley. They already passed it in San Francisco. They're trying to pass it in Berkeley where, you know, the pigs that just kick you and mess with you, make you get up if you're lying down anywhere sleeping in public. And if you're sitting down on a curb or something, they can cite you. It's insane what's going on today. We have to rebel. We have to resist. Or we'll all lose our humanity.
That's ma'am.
That's heavy. Sister, did I answer your question? Do you have another question for
Yes, sir. Thank you, sister, for your continued struggle and your spirit. I love your spirit, queen. Your sister, I'm sorry. And I'll continue to struggle here and create revolutionary conditions for our people from the hills and smiles of Atlanta. So I'll pop to the people, sister.
Thank you. Thank you. Much love to you.
Much love to you, too, sir.
All right.
That's what I'm talking about. We'll take another call here at area code 216-855. Area code 216-855. You're on the air with Kilu and Yasha talking about Black Power Radio and the topic Blood in Our Eye. Black Power. Question or comment? 216-855. Your mic's open. Question or comment? All right, we'll keep that moving. So, Tequila, Mama Kili talked about so much in that. We got about 7 minutes left.
You got another call?
Not yet. Let me give
okay,
the number out.
Let's give the phone.
Yes, ma'am. For those of you listening via web, if you have a question for Mama Kilu, the number is 646-478-4447. Again, 646-478-4447. And we'll take another call here in just a second as soon as our sister comes back.
Okay.
Again,
can I quote George in the meanwhile?
Absolutely.
Okay. The corporative state allows for no genuinely free political opposition. They only allow meaningless gatherings where they can plant more spies than participants. They feel secure in their ability to mold the opinion of the people interested only in wages. However, real revolutionary activity will draw panic-stricken gunfire or heart attacks.
Straight up. And that's real.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah, we can't be fooled by these creeps. They've projected that they're going to spend $11 billion on this campaign. It just keeps going up. Up. And I have on my blog, I wish people would take the time to read it. It's too long. Most people's attention spans are pretty short these days. But if you go to www.mynamekilunyasha.blogspot.com, KILUNYASHA.blogspot.com, you can find a lot of stuff that I've written. And one of the things I wrote was No Politics as Usual, and it's all about electoral politics. I first wrote it in 92, tried to get it published in real magazines and stuff like Ebony and The Progressive and the Z Magazine and shit, but they wouldn't touch it. So then in 96, I updated it and tried again. That didn't work. And then the Internet came along, and I said, oh, okay, 2004, let me put it out on the Internet, you know, jacking up Kerry and them and Bush. But no, so it's on there, and it's long, but I think, and it's detailed, but it quotes a lot of George and Malcolm and W.E.B. Du Bois, who once said that if we can continue to put our faith in the Democrats or the Republic, may we all. Oh, I forgot. I can't remember the quote.
We know exactly where you're going, though. Know exactly where you're going. We got two more callers calling in now. Take the first one here. Area code 850284. You're on the air with Sister Kilu and Yasha. Your question, your comment, please. Black Power.
My name is Mafia Shakur again. I want to ask a question. You really believe?
Yes,
I mean, you believe in that old saying, like the black man's like the product of his environment, or our youth is like influenced by our environment. And then what can I do to make me a life better revolutionary for my people?
Right.
Because the last part I didn't quite get.
I say you believe that our youth is a product of their environment, or is they influenced by their environment? What can I do to be a great revolutionary for my people?
Oh, good question.
Beautiful.
Okay. Scientists, meaning psychiatry, the medical professions, the psychiatric profession, you know, the geneticists, all pretty much agree in today, and you should read Dorothy Roberts' book, Fatal Invention, how science, politics, recreate race in the 21st century. And basically, there's one human race, and the white supremacists would have you believe otherwise, of course, because they want to continue to make us feel as if we are genetically inferior and genetic this, that, or the other thing, okay? But the truth is that there are no species of the human race. There's one human race. And so that said, scientists also agreed in today's real world that environment trumps heredity, basically. And that's an old argument. But it's really they've got enough ways to study and prove now, and they've got, you know, all kinds of technology to help them. So they've come to the conclusion that, in other words, if you have most babies are born, either healthy or unhealthy. And if they're healthy, the environment is everything, because the healthy baby can be put into an environment that does not give it food, nourishment, physical nourishment, doesn't give them love, which babies thrive on. It could put them in a loveless, non-nourishing kind of environment that will retard its growth and development, okay? That will not develop and grow as well as healthy as it would if it were put in an environment where all of its nutritional needs are met, its recreational needs are met, it gets all the love it needs, and so forth and so on. And opportunities to play and be creative. The child is not quashed. It's not stifled. Its creativity is allowed to be free. Okay? So you'll have two different children growing up. One will grow and develop healthily. The other will not grow in a healthy way, but will have a lot of problems, both emotional and physical.
Ma'am.
Does that basically answer your question?
Or did yes, ma'am.
Get off on a tangent like I do a lot?
We don't mind. We don't mind at all. Brother Mafia, did that get to the point what you're asking?
We as black people understand we have not been given, a fair start in most cases. However, we also have to recognize nowadays that this is a significant black bourgeoisie that's been entrenched for centuries in this country. It's very healthy. Their children have gotten all the privilege that white children have gotten. Now, doesn't mean that they don't suffer from racism. I understand that. But they do have lots of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
No doubt about it. That's right.
So, and at the same time, a whole lot of those folks are as classist as they can be.
That's
when
real.
It comes to poor folks.
Mm-hmm.
Haiti is the perfect example, with its tiny,
yep.
light-skinned, colored elite that has been in cahoots with the U.S. government and France and Britain and all the Western imperialists against the masses of poor people of Haiti have been complicit in their exploitation of Haitians, gross exploitation of Haitians. We can't forget, that color is not what determines politics.
Teach.
Okay? We really have to, and like George said, of course, when he was talking about, he used race, the white race, but if he were alive today, he would know that there's the human race, and blacks have an African-American culture, and either revolutionary or reactionary politics. But the differences are political and cultural, okay?
That's real.
Okay.
Either or. That's right. Either or.
Right. And we can see a lot clearly, and we can make a sentence. We won't make the mistakes the party made. The party was pushing away people who wanted to, Puerto Ricans and, people who and some light-skinned blacks, you know, mistrusting us because we were light and had light, so-called light-skinned people. Well, yeah, so is that our fault, you know, that we were born a little lighter or darker or something? Nobody's fault. You know, who?
Right.
And it's not a fault to be born light. It's not a fault to be born dark. It's not a fault
Jeez.
To be any color. You know, Mother Nature made us lots of colors, just like flowers are different colors. Come on. We don't need to go there. We don't need to be buy into their color-struck racism, you know? And if we keep judging books by their cover, color, we'll make mistakes like the monumental mistake that black Americans made and white liberals made putting Obama into office.
Good teaching. It's great teaching.
Look what he's done.
Teach.
Jeez.
But you got to say that. You got to say that because some people can't see that, Mama Kilu.
Yeah.
Oh, man, this guy has just torn up habeas corpus. He's destroyed that, you know.
No, that's right.
Legalized COINTELPRO, you know.
Straight up.
You know, you want to put it in non-legal legalese? You or I can be detained without trial, without jury, without anything, on suspicion of being a terrorist or something, whatever they choose, without any due process, and disappeared.
That's right.
And our relatives may not even be able to find us.
Mm-hmm.
Right to do that now under Obama. Okay?
That's right.
Because he signed midnight while y'all were partying. Okay,
teach.
And I was asleep. I was watching fireworks through my window. He was New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
It out December 31st. He signed the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, and that just shredded habeas corpus. The Magna
That's right.
Carta, 13th century, the 1200s or something?
Mm-hmm.
Knocked the Magna Carta out of the box. Come on. The guy's dropping drones. He dropped, I don't know how many times more drones than Bush ever thought about dropping.
Yep.
He's Bush on
That's
steroids,
right.
And people are missing it.
I teach.
Why
Age.
Are they missing it? If he were white, if he were Bush, we might have had a revolution this last 3 years with the shit
right.
that he's done.
Straight up.
But no, we're so pacified, it's mind-boggling. I get calls from a brother on death row, a brother, you hear me, named Shaka. And I tried to tell him about Obama and what he's done. I told him, I said, but you know, he's deporting 400,000 people a year. That's like.
You said 400,000?
Yes. And if
wow.
you add up three, and just in 3 years, last time I looked, four times three was 12.
That's right.
And that's like 1,200,000 in 3 years. Now, I don't know what it's going to be at the end of four, but it's well
Good
over
grief.
A million. Moving on, 2 million that he has deported. Bush ain't even thought about deporting that many people. He has the right. Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld have been, all of them, especially Rumsfeld and Cheney, have been brought up on charges in the international court. He can prosecute them. He won't. He could prosecute.
Right.
He could prosecute these criminals, these crooks that caused the financial collapse. gambling away our money with fraudulent behavior practice. And
that's
he
right.
To them. Okay?
That's real.
Who is he working? He promised to close Guantanamo. Did he close it?
No, he didn't.
Has he done anything for a political prisoner, one?
No, ma'am.
Has he done anything to alleviate the revolving door prison system that young black and brown men experience every day of their lives?
No, ma'am, he has not.
I have a son. His name is Jabbar, and I call most young people my sons and daughters, okay? And if they're real young, I call them my grandchildren, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
He grew up in these projects, down the street projects. Young black child, dark skin, I'm saying this purposefully. I don't describe people by color anymore. I stopped doing that unless I'm making a point. But he grew up a little dark-skinned child of drug-addicted parents in this community, and I took him under my wing and tried to do the best I could to, you know, help him. And recently he was criticizing another family member of mine for being a revolving door case, and I looked at him and I said, hello? And I said, how many times have you been in and out of prison? 39. And he's looking at, and he's going to be 40 this month.
Okay.
That's almost as many times as he is old. It is as many times he is old.
Yes, it is.
That's how bad it is. And I know because I've been there for him every time he's gone in and come out, only I didn't realize it was that many. He's out now. He's been out for a while, and I think he's going to stay out, and we're close, and I love him. And he just became a grandfather, and you can find him on my Facebook. You know, he's doing well now, but I'm telling you what I know. I'm from experience, and that's why I love young poor people, because I know their problems.
Right, that's right.
I know what's happening to them. I'm not guessing or reading about it. I know what's happening to them. I know how they do them. And I know what we have to do. We have to stop going along with it. We have to visit our people in prison, our young people in prison. We have to go up there and start making our presence known. We have to go to the prisons.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, we have to write to them. We have to write to the wardens. We have to raise hell. We have to make our presence felt. That they can't our sons and our daughters like this.
Right.
No, you can't. And journalists need to demand entrance into these prisons to see what's going on. I got paranoid because the last time I was in prison, I was visited Geronimo as a journalist with press credentials so I could get a tape recorder in there in Mule Creek. And a pig sat right in between. No, I won't call him a pig. He was just doing his job. He was a guard.
You said it right. You go, yes, ma'am.
I'm trying to be cool. Anyway, I feel listening to every word. I didn't bite my tongue. Geronimo didn't. He didn't give a damn. You're going to get a political ed class today. Shit. So,
that's right.
You know, but he sat there. I mean, at the table with us. So the next thing I know, that was 95, and then later on in 95, or either 95 or 96, that was the end of it. No more journalists allowed in prison.
Shut that down.
Shut it down, okay? So I'm telling you what I know, that we need to demand access because they're torturing and beating and brutalizing and medically neglecting to death our people.
Yes, ma'am.
Sons, our daughters, our uncles, our fathers, our brothers, our sisters. Come on, y'all. Our lovers. Come on.
That's real. That's right.
How can they incarcerate so many of us so many times and we just keep turning a blind eye? None of my relatives, none of my friends ever been in prison. Hello?
That's right. All the time.
Stop acting
all
like it's a secret. It's not a secret. It shouldn't be
right.
A secret anymore. We have to fess up that they're taking our mm-hmm. sons and daughters. You know, my daughter's a revolving. I might as well fess up too. My daughter's become a revolving case because she's drug addicted. They are.
Uh-huh.
She's drug addicted.
Mm-hmm.
That's another.
It's in all
thing.
Our families.
This war on drugs is a monster. It's grabbing
right.
our kids and screwing them for life because there are
That's
is
right.
no rehab. There are no drug
right.
programs. There are no rehab programs. No drug therapy.
Right.
Only a war that is designed to keep us in and out and in and out and in and out of jail.
That's right. That's right. That's real talk. We're in the after hour show now, so we're still streaming live on the web. Like I'm saying, we're loving.
Oh, I've been running my mouth a long time.
You've been dropping it. The audience cannot say we haven't gotten politically educated tonight. I'm glad you touched about the political prisons and prisons of war. I was going to ask you that. Can you talk to us just a little bit more about the importance of remembering political prisons, what I call the prisons of war, and those of our families behind the bars? You're already into it, but can you just stay on that?
Well, that's really important because yesterday, August 8th, I marked the 34th. I was wrong. I had to correct myself. I thought it was 32 because I can't add, but 34 years, my people. Come on. The Move 9. Come on. They're literally 8
right.
now because Merle Africa died in prison, and I remember
mm-hmm.
that. And it's just so hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, these folks didn't do anything but say they're not going to renounce their culture, their revolutionary culture.
They're
That's
not, right.
and their revolutionary politics. They're not going to renounce it. They're not going to renounce Move.
That's right.
Or they're in prison. If that ain't political, I don't know what is.
Good teaching.
Okay. Leonard Peltier. They know he's
That's right.
See, they know it. They know who killed him. They don't care.
Mm-hmm.
He's political.
Right.
How many years is he in there now? I can't count anymore. 40?
Way too many. Yeah, easily.
Now, Sundiata Kohli, he's been in there 40 years. I email him.
That's
I
right.
love him. He's a beautiful man. He's 74. Why? They just denied him parole. What for? What the hell for? It cost them three times the $49,000 I know they spend on the jabars that go in and out of jail. $49,000
right.
a year they make off of them, of that.
That's period. Right.
$49,000 a year, they could send them through Harvard for that.
Teach.
Or at least NYU. Come on.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it costs triple to house Yogi, high security housing unit SHU, which is high tech monster control unit. You know, 24/7, locked in a cage, windowless, you know, sensory deprivation in the extreme, no contact visits, no phone calls out of there, not even death row prisoners get phone calls. He doesn't. Mm. He hasn't been able to talk to his mother except through a glass, an hour visit on a weekend or a holiday. You know, he
wow.
hasn't been able to embrace her in 40 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
Come on.
Wow.
You know, he's been in prison, Rochelle, 49 years in prison. They took his whole life.
That's right.
And they took Yogi's whole life. Went in 19, he's 67. He's been in for, 48, you know. And I'm close to Yogi. I've been up there four times to see him. I'd love to go back up there, but it's such an expense. It's a huge expense. And I just can't afford it. It's a long, long.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the way by the Oregon border, northwest corner of the most pristine territory in California, the Redwood Territory. And they carved out this monster gray area. It's just, you go up there, you just can't believe the evil, the sheer evil of a solid concrete block, cement, that you wouldn't put a dog or a cat in. The animal rights people would raise hell, but we let them put humans in there and don't raise any hell.
Right, exactly.
Windowless.
Exactly.
Concrete blocks with only a door to get in the place. That's the security housing unit. I was blown away when I saw that thing. I said, oh, my God, how diabolical is this? Yeah, this is no end to their inhumanity. And they've lost their humanity. You know, Brother Eugene Thomas asked me one day, he said, what do you, when you say power to the people, who do you mean? I thought that was a really good question. And I said, well, I mean all of those who haven't lost their humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people who can order and be complicit in drones that kill, you know, that target wedding parties and funeral parties because on the excuse that one terrorist attended it. I mean, that's the level of humanity that
That's bestiality.
Yeah.
That's exactly.
I shouldn't even said level of humanity. I said you're right, my brother.
I know. I know what you meant.
Level of humanity. They have been dehumanized. Those
That's
people
right.
have been dehumanized. I call them creeps.
Yeah.
You know, because I
yep.
can say that on the air, and I don't have to get if I'm on a program that the FCC has something.
Right.
To.
Right. Right.
But. But creeps is, you know, it's good enough. It tells you that they are creeps.
Yes, ma'am. No doubt about it. Again, you're dropping so much on us, and we're so thankful. I guess I'll give you a couple more questions. I want to hold you all day, but I do want to get these last couple questions out to you. Mommy Kilua, in your final analysis here, you've given us a lot of organizing tools. Can you talk about the importance of family? You talked about the dysfunction of family, the drug epidemic, and the wars on it. Can you talk about the importance of our families and pulling the family together?
Right. Okay. First of all, I have to start off by saying that I've decided that my family, this is how I live as a revolutionary,
mm-hmm.
my family are all those who love me and I love.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Not necessarily relatives.
Okay.
Blood relatives, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But some of my relatives don't love me.
Gotcha.
And I love them in a way like I love, like agape, you know, love that King talked about. You know, I care about
mm-hmm.
them, but
mm-hmm.
they're not loving, lovable people, you know, some of them.
Right.
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're politically messed up, you know, they're reactionaries. So I try not to... I don't go there too much. I try to distance
okay.
I distance myself from reactionaries.
Gotcha.
Regardless as to whether they might be family, quote unquote.
Makes sense.
Okay. I try to surround myself with people who have a lot of love and care about other people. That's a fundamental because, as Che said, at the risk of sounding ridiculous, you know, a true revolutionary is motivated by a great love.
To love, that's right.
Right. Great love of the people, and I always question my litmus test for people that I'm to call themselves leftist or revolutionary. And you know, I agree with Malcolm when he said we should stop putting labels on right and left and middleist. He said rightist, leftist, and middleist. He said we should stop putting labels on ourselves. And it's,
right.
I thought that, you know, and I take a theory and I always check it out in practice. And I kept twirling that around in my mind over the years. And I began to notice and realize that, yes, he's so right because there are people on the so-called left. And I say that now. I use so-called and so-called right. There are people on the so-called left who are liars, and there are people on the so-called right that are who are liars.
That's right.
There are people on the so-called left that you cannot trust because they're liars, and there are people on the so-called right you cannot trust because they're liars. Now, that said, there are people on both the left and the right who like to tell the truth as they see it, might be misguided, but as they see it, who like telling the truth, who are basically good people, and if they saw somebody, you know, fall down in the street, would stop and help them out, okay?
Right.
So what I say to myself is, it doesn't matter to me what somebody tells me they are, particularly. What matters mostly to me is what that person does and the feel that I get from that person. Is that person a good person in the sense that they're kind, they're honest, they're generous, they're respectful, they're decent human beings, okay, who respect the human rights of other people? You know, those
right.
are the people I want to surround myself with. And I also want to surround myself with people who are doing positive, constructive things.
That's right.
And that can be a lot of different things, taking care of other people, taking care of good care of their children, taking good care of elderly, looking out for their brothers and sisters. There's so many ways to manifest that you care about people, you love people. And believe me, we should have faith in the people. And I just read a thing, a piece today that was I forget what paper it was. It was on my Kindle, and I think it was in the Washington Post or the New York Times or something. But it was the story of one of the victims of the he was a victim. He was wounded in that theater shooting. Okay, seriously wounded. And girlfriend was injured badly also. And he wrote about it. And he said that he had been traveling all across America because he kind of been hearing, you know, that, oh, I know, he went somewhere out to a foreign country, and the impression and the questions that he got about Americans, he realized he couldn't answer because he didn't really know about America. So he and his buddy decided they were going to do a bike ride across America. Okay, they literally did. And so they were going from one state to the next. And, of course, they had white skin privilege. Light skin privilege, I'll give them that. So, in terms of what happened. But it still holds true, regardless. And I think it would have held true no matter what color they ran into. But I don't know. But anyway, the point is, he said they everywhere they went, and he cited a few examples, people were really kind to them, and they were so surprised that people offered so many kindnesses to them, you know, along the way. And it refuted the idea that, you know, beware of strangers, watch out, people are terrible, people are evil, people are this, people are that. But it was like, what I'm trying to say is, like Miles said, have faith in the people. And I try to do that. I tried to live my life like that, having faith in the people. And the people have really never betrayed me. But we cannot expect, if you say have faith in the people and then you discard half the population because you don't like how they look, how are you going to know who's nice or who isn't, who's kind or who isn't? You understand what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
You know?
Absolutely.
Human beings are really, most human beings are decent people. Most human beings want the same things. They want to be able to raise a family, or if they don't want to raise a family, they want to live a life that's productive and creative. They want to have a sense of freedom. They want to be able to travel. They want to be able to do this, that, or the other thing. But most people really want the basics, you know, healthy food, decent clothes, a good education, good health care. We all need those things, and we all want those things. We all want to be able to have opportunities to pursue our goals and our dreams, you know?
That's right.
That's a human thing. It's no particular group.
Mm-hmm. It's universal.
It's universal. Thank you. And I think if we have to become global, because we can't win unless the people of the world unite. Mao was so correct a long, long time ago. And unfortunately, you know, China got taken over by the capitalists, and mm-hmm. Russia got taken over by capitalists, and Cuba is about to turn capitalist. And what are we going to do? Are we the African states? There are no socialist African states. They're all in partnership with the Western corporations that are plundering their resources right now.
In their pocket. Yeah. Yep.
You know? So. People, but those are still the 1%. All those, that leadership in the world, you know, those kings and prime ministers and dictators, and they represent the 1%, the corporate elite that buys them, you know, and pays them and is complicit in ripping off their people, you know.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, but there's still the 1%, and I heard a figure this morning, my brother, that 1%, the global 1%, owns 61% of the global wealth. Juxtapose
Jeez.
That next to the fact that about half the world's people, which is about 3.5 billion people now, is living on $2 or less a day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
It's crazy.
It's insane and obscene, and we cannot tolerate it. We're the majority. We're the 99%. But what's stopping us? Our own stupidity, our own stuck-on-stupid racism, our own stuck-on-stupid homophobia, our own stuck-on-stupid classism. Come on, y'all. The only class we should be warring against is the... Right? My phone is running out of steam here.
Okay, we lost that last one. I think I guess your phone was beeping. You were saying the only class that should be worried about was what, Mama Kulu?
The only class we should worry about is the ruling class.
Straight up.
And them. The rest of us, we need to educate to liberate. That's the job.
Straight up.
Now, how do you educate?
Straight up.
Can't educate if you don't know anything.
Right.
You have to study, and you have to make studying a part of your lifestyle. Very
good
much.
Teaching.
Political education classes. The teacher is the student. The student is the teacher. Each one teach. Each one teach one.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well,
okay.
I know you sound like you run out. Are you running out of battery juice?
Yeah.
Okay.
And somebody. Hold of me, so I'm kind of talked out too.
It's all good. Go ahead and give us your closing comments. We thank you. I want to thank you on behalf of Dr. Malik Zulu Shabazz and Black Panther Party and all the people, Black Power Radio, everybody listening. We really appreciate you. I want you to know from me to you that you're welcome anytime on the show. I'm just telling you.
Okay, well
straight from me.
Here's my final quote, and it's straight from George. And I ended my paper with it. It said, settle your quarrels. Come together. Understand the reality of our situation. Understand that fascism is already here. That people are dying who could be saved. That generations more will live poor, butchered half-lives if you fail to act. Do what must be done. Discover your humanity and your love in revolution. And take care of your... Free all political prisoners, free all prisoners of war, and also visit your, release them, get them released, because like Yogi said, I'm already free. But the bottom line is this. Take care of your relatives in prison, too. Your
That's right.
friends
That's right.
in prison. Your neighbors in prison. Look after the people in your community who are in prison. Look after them, too. Power to the people.
Beautiful.
And much love.
Power to the people.
And thank you so much, my brother Fred, for letting me run my mouth for so long.
No, thank, Mama Kulu, thank you. Thank you so much. And I can say I'm honored, and I appreciate this is actually it's my birthday today, so this is
oh
the best.
Oh my goodness! Happy birthday! How young are you?
I'm 31 now.
Oh, you're a baby.
I'm just
that's
yeah.
A great
so I'm a, I, so so I'm like I say when I say I'm your Panther Cub, I'm a Panther Cub, and so
you're a year older than I was when I joined the party.
Yes, ma'am. Yes. 30. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Hey, Brother
yes,
Love,
ma'am.
Have a great evening, and power to the people, and Vence at Amos. We will win.
Yes, ma'am. Power to the people. Thank you so much, Ma. And like
pleasure
I said,
was
I,
all
I will,
mine.
I'll send you a copy of the show.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Brothers and sisters, that is... Wow, that is Mama Kilu and Yasha. Kilu and Yasha. If you did not hear this show from start to finish, I'm going to tell you straight. Go all the way back to the beginning at the end of the show and get this broadcast. This is one for the history books. This is a historic occasion, a historic evening. And I want to, again, thank all of you who are listening on Black Power Radio. The official broadcast of the new Black Panther Party. We appreciate you. And for those of you who are interested in supporting this broadcast, hell, you can also make donations. Make a donation. Keep us on the air. We want to keep all kinds of guests on the radio broadcast in the near future. And so you can send a check or money order. Make it payable to Black Power Radio, Kev Sean Kwali, to P.O. Box 11757, P.O. Box 11757, Louisville, Kentucky, 40211. And again, make sure that you tune in this Sunday night. I believe this Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern, we'll have a special broadcast from the National Chairman, Dr. and Attorney Malik Zulu Shabazz. He's coming in on this Sunday, and then we're rolling right in again to Monday night, our regular broadcast at 8 p.m., and then another broadcast right back at you on Wednesday. So we're rolling. The radio broadcast and the Ministry of Information and Communications is rolling. If you're interested in joining this movement, the new Black Panther Party, go to the website, www.newblackpanther.com. Again, that's newblackpanther.com. And hit us on the email, nbpphq@yahoo.com. And so we say like this. We say it's black power to black people. It's all power to the people. It's freedom or death. And if black people are not free, nobody's free. Until next time, black power.
Once you change your philosophy, you change your thought pattern. Once you change your thought pattern, you change your attitude. Once you change your attitude, it changes your behavior pattern. And then you go on into some action. As long as you got a sit-down philosophy, you'll have a sit-down thought pattern. And as long as you think that old sit-down thought, you'll be in some kind of sit-down action. They'll have you sitting in everywhere. It's not so good to refer to what you're going to do as a sit-in. Then right there, it castrates you. Right there, it brings you down. What goes with it? What think of the image of someone sitting? An old woman can sit. An old man can sit. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing and some fighting to back that up.